Hello and welcome to the Counterweight Podcast, where we talk about how we can strive for a world in which freedom and reason are at the forefront of all human society. In this week's podcast, Elizabeth and I will be taking a deep dive into the concept of groupthink, and in particular, the extent to which it can be applied to social media and cancel culture. Okay, so welcome everybody. Today we thought we'd have a look at one of the major concepts that is often talked about with regards to cancel culture, which is groupthink. In a sense, very, very briefly, before we consider this in any detail, groupthink is this idea where people come together and think as a group rather than as individuals, and that this is leading to cancellation. But whilst this is often used very informally, it's not used in much depth. There's not been any really rigorous analysis of whether the concept of groupthink from psychology actually applies. And so we thought we'd do that today. We'd have a look and see whether it applies or not. So, Elizabeth, could you give us a more robust definition of groupthink?
Well, I'm actually going to read from Janice's original little description here. So, a mode of thinking that people engage in when they are deeply involved in a cohesive in-group, when the members' strivings for unanimity override their motivation to realistically appraise alternative courses of action. So in much of this article that we are that we read together, and the leader is sort of is, I would say, it's almost blamed for this, right? That the leader is the one that is somehow guiding the group so forcefully towards a unanimous or cohesive decision that the group feels as though it can, others in the group feel as though they cannot raise objections or, make other comments, you know, that might alter the progression towards a decision, right?
Yeah, it seems to make sense. I mean, from looking at the paper that you shared with me, and having done some reading into the topic myself before with my own research, it seems to have been something that was used largely, if not exclusively, to retrospectively describe the reasons for certain policy failures. So the classic one that I've researched would be the Yom Kippur War. So basically what happened in the Yom Kippur War is that Egypt had a war with Israel. Jordan was involved, a few other countries, and Israel had absolutely obliterated their enemies completely. Then immediately after the war, Israel was in this position where they thought, we're untouchable. Nobody can match us. We've shown how superior our forces are. And they would be idiotic to try and attack us. And that was correct for a while. But what happened afterwards was then Egypt built up their forces bit by bit, and they started pushing. They started moving troops back towards the border, back again, towards the border, back again. And within the Israeli intelligence services, this idea came that, okay, they're doing this, but the reason they're doing this is for domestic consumption, to make them look strong in front of their own people. And the Egyptians were aware that the Israelis thought that. And so they kept doing it, and they built up this kind of this normalcy. They made this new normal. But within the Israeli intelligence and military community at the time, there were people who genuinely believed that the Egyptians were going to attack. And of course, they turned out to be right, because the Egyptians did attack. But the groupthink set in. So the dominant narrative was that no, this is just for domestic consumption. They're not going to really attack. And if you questioned that, you wouldn't get invited to meetings. You wouldn't be promoted. And so people who were suspicious that Egypt would attack, they might say it in the corridors or in the toilets under their breath, but it wasn't something that they would mention at meetings. And so the groupthink then set that narrative that Egypt wouldn't attack in stone, And of course, Egypt did attack. And despite the fact that Egypt was, as the Israelis were quite confident, you know, vastly inferior in terms of technology and their military, because Israel was so unprepared, because they'd been quite arrogant about it, the Egyptians did horrendous damage to the Israelis. And I think most Israeli scholars would probably agree that that was the most painful day in the history of Israel as a modern nation state.
So in that example, the group was built or emerged, they culled some from the herd and sort of created a group that was willing to engage in groupthink, right? In your example?
Very much so, yeah.
And I think that in some of the other famous examples like Watergate and the Bay of Pigs, I think that those groups already existed. They were like a presidential cabinet or, a group of personal advisors or whatever. And so in that case, maybe the group process created the groupthink. Or another way of talking about this, they call it group mind, right? So as if the group is all of one mind. And so it's kind of interesting to think about those two kind of ways of creating groupthink, right? One is maybe because the group is already very cohesive, they have great respect for one another, maybe have made solid decisions in the past that have been, praised or found, resulted in good outcomes. And another where dissenters are sort of disinvited or, again, sort of like culled from the group so that a groupthink is more created.
Yes. Yeah, so in my example, I think there was the group originally, before the group's think set in, was an intelligence directorate, Amman, which was the main one in Israel at the time. And there were dissenting voices, but those dissenting voices were gradually shut out. I think maybe we need to define this concept cohesiveness.
Yes, because even in the article, cohesiveness actually comes under some question, right? That maybe that's not the most important variable. So if we go to the section on characteristics, so Janice describes three characteristics that are most important in leading towards groupthink. So one, which we've talked about, the pressure towards uniformity. So which then would, aspects of which are self-censorship, illusion of unanimity, direct pressure on dissenters, which you just described, and self-appointed mind guards. I like that, mind guards. Now, this would be the most most important aspect. And the other two, although they're listed as one and two, if one and two don't exist, which I'll share here in a second, then the third, this pressure towards uniformity, would be overcome. So number one would be overestimation of the group. So an illusion of invulnerability, which you just described, right, in the Yom Kippur War, and belief in inherent morality. Belief in an inherent morality. And then number two they list here is those producing closed-mindedness, which would be collective rationalization and stereotyped images of outgroups.
Right. So this is really, really interesting with regards to Yom Kippur. So there was, and I think the Israelis themselves, so I'm working from two books by a guy called Bar Joseph that we can put in the show notes. And he worked within Israeli intelligence and then taught at university and so on, but became an academic. But he openly admits, and I don't think anyone within Israel would deny this, any military scholars, that there was quite a bit of racism directed towards the Egyptians at the time. They thought that they were backwards and stupid. And the Egyptians themselves, interestingly, knew that the Israelis thought that about them and played into it.
Mm.
So, for example, the troops on... So what eventually the Egyptians had to do was cross the Suez Canal to attack Egypt, which is a really, really difficult thing to do. And the Israelis were like, no, they can't do that. There's no way they could pull this off. And what the Egyptians commanded their troops to do was to take their shirts off, smoke cigarettes, laze around, sunbathe, do all kinds of things to make them look like they were disorganized and stupid, to create that impression, to reinforce that impression within the Israelis, which they would then later take advantage of. So the stigmatization of the outgroup is an interesting feature and one that was really, really exploited.
So again, sort of that third piece, the self-censorship, illusion of unanimity, this pressure, you know, towards uniformity, is especially problematic when it happens early in the process. And so that sounds like something also that you were describing, is that we have to, you know, sort of silence the naysayers quickly and start. And they talk about in the article, and Janice really focuses on times of stress when there's some urgency to the decision, and you know, that coming to a decision quickly is part of, you know, is part of the decision. It really is, you know, that time constraint is influencing perhaps the process, because you're faced with sort of a satisficing model where you have to come up with the based on the intelligence that we have, you know, the information that we have, the time constraints, and, you know, our capabilities, you know, our cognitive capabilities in, you know, within the group, a bounded rationality kind of decision, which is a satisficing versus a maximizing decision. And that Janice really talks about how, you know, that's a particularly vulnerable sort of combination, right, in terms of groupthink. However, it sounds like what you're talking about emerged much over a longer period of time.
Yeah, and in fact, it wasn't born out of, yeah, because Janice really makes that clear, right? That, and I'm not sure whether he's saying that this is a prerequisite, this
right.
kind of, this, you know, crisis time that brings about the group,
or thing, just a vulnerability,
vulnerability,
it's
a catalyst, maybe even. Because with regards to the Yom Kippur situation, it was much more complacency,
okay.
Like it evolved over a period of time, and they were over a number of years, and they were very complacent, they didn't feel any sense of crisis at all. And it's the very fact that they didn't feel any sense of crisis that led to the fiasco that happened.
So one of the things, you know, you had said about cohesiveness. So in this article, again, we'll post the, you know, the citation in the podcast notes, but they really, the author really outlines another sort of, they're saying that cohesiveness isn't necessarily, it's not even necessary. I would say necessary, but not sufficient, but maybe not even necessary, right?
Right.
That there's another sort of path to groupthink, so, you know, I mean, specifically, I mean, this is a quote, strong affective, so emotional, strong emotional ties between group members are not a necessary variable in producing groupthink, according to several of these studies that the author is summarizing. Low status members may anticipate thoughts, wishes, or commands from leader figures and adapt their own thinking and actions accordingly. And so, you know, so while the cohesiveness is a part of Janice's original theory, this author is outlining follow-up research that sort of, you know, found that there wasn't, that cohesiveness was not necessarily as important as self-censorship in deference to decision making that was already underway, or to a leader that didn't seem open, or a process that wasn't open to hearing alternative viewpoints, right?
I wonder if that's what we're seeing in places like China and Russia today, for example, where you have a leader like Putin, for example, who is not an idiot, but has seemingly made a really stupid decision to invade a country. And I wonder if he has selected for the people around him to be very much yes men, sycophants. Mm-hmm. And if they disagree with anything Putin says, they will just censor themselves and be complicit. I wonder if that's what's happening there. I wonder if that's what's happening in China as well. There's cohesiveness in the sense that it emerges from people who genuinely believe in the cause, and then there seems to be complicity.
Now, your background is, of course, war theory, and so I'm wondering, I think there was maybe one or two, you know, very brief military references in this article, but what are your thoughts with regard to, other than the Yom Kippur War, but just sort of, you know, more generally, other kinds of military examples, maybe even everyday kinds of decision-making?
Well, I mean, it makes sense to stay in Israel because Israel is the place where this has been really formalized into the military structure there, whereas it hasn't been so much in other places. And also, the book, if you want to read about this, the book, which we can put on in the show notes, the best book to read is a book called Strategic Warning Intelligence. Let me pull it up. By Gendry and Gordon. And they have some examples in there. So, Gentry and Gordon, Strategic Warning Intelligence. So I actually interviewed some members of the Israeli Defense Forces about exactly this. And that they said that since the Yom Kippur warning, they have a rule, which is basically if 9 people agree, then the 10th person, even if he strongly agrees, has to disagree, has to try and give a really good argument against the position. And so what they're trying to do is to create a kind of a group ethos wherein it's kind of it immunizes itself to groupthink. And I think mm-hmm. that's mentioned in the article we looked at, right? It says that not all
yes,
groups...
Yes, just very briefly, yes. And it's interesting because... I talked with one of my research students yesterday about this article, and just to get her thoughts. And one of the things that she came away with, she was decidedly unsympathetic to the followers. So she gave her own examples of, you know, sort of group work or just sort of, you know, small like friend groups and stuff. And that, at what point, you know, she just asked me, like, at what point is it not up to the, or at what point is it the followers, sort of responsibility, you know, that if the leader or the person who's maybe even informally sort of assigned the leadership role in these kind of, you know, these less formal groups than a military or government group says, you know, does anybody have anything else to, you know, any other comments? Like, I'm not sure I'm, you know, on the right path here. And if nobody says anything, you know, at what point is it there, sort of on the followers? And I think that's really left out kind of this article, you know, because they really do blame, the leader more. It doesn't come across, I shouldn't say it comes across as blame, but it just keeps coming back around to, you know, oh, the leader isn't providing an environment where, people would speak out. But as we kind of as we sort of move towards my, like, social media, where is the leader? right? There is no leader. And at what point is it up to the followers to sort of, to quit following a leader that doesn't exist or doesn't want to lead?
So here's another really interesting historic example, Chairman Mao, right? Famous for having this massive cult of the personality around him and making abysmal decisions as a consequence. I mean, for example, do you know about the sparrows?
No.
So during the time, during his time, he was worried that sparrows were coming in and eating the crops. So they had all of the villagers stand around the crops trying to keep these sparrows away. And what he didn't realize is that the sparrows were actually not eating the crops, they were eating the insects. And so by keeping the sparrows away, you're actually causing more of a famine. But when they figured it out, it was like, no, we can't lose face. We have to keep on with this decision. It's very similar, I think. I mean, you know, we can't really go behind the scenes at the moment, but I think a similar thing is happening with zero COVID, where it's not really stopping the disease. It may be slowing it a tiny bit, but it's not very effective and it's killing the economy. But now that decision is made, they can't break away from it. The thing with Mao, the interesting thing with Mao was, is that he recognized, I mean, obviously he didn't know what groupthink was, but he recognized that a cult of the personality had formed around him. And he spoke about the fact that this was really bad for him and it was really bad for China. And yet he could do nothing but reinforce it anyway. So he was aware that it was bad, but he carried on with it anyway. So, I mean, it raises the question, what can leaders do?
Right. And that's basically what my student was asking, you know, what can a leader do? And one of the things that she suggested was individual meetings, you know, to actually have one-on-one meetings, because, you know, then like the group is not present, right? And to have those, you know, one-on-one meetings, sort of to collect information in a different way. Of course, there's, you know, different other processes like the Delphi method or whatever, where people aren't identified. Maybe we'll come together as a group later, but we're going to maybe start with one-on-one. Or if you recognize groupthink, then you maybe go to a one-on-one where you have discussions and it becomes more clear, maybe outside of the group, even though you're still part of the group, maybe outside of the group, that there's an opportunity to share a difference of opinion.
Yeah. So in my mind, when I think about what makes a good leader, what I naively kind of intrinsically go for is this kind of charismatic dominance kind of leadership, right? And that would seem to be precisely the kind of leadership that would fall victim most easily to groupthink, you know, the big speaker, the big charisma, that kind of thing. The most effective leader I ever worked under was a woman who would never really put her opinions out in front. She would ask questions. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? She would elicit opinions from everybody in the room. She would balance the opinions out. And then only after having kind of got a read of the room and balanced different opinions, only then would she give her opinion. And that worked really, really, really well. That was really managing kind of diversity of thought very, very well indeed.
Yeah. In fact, in this article, they cite a study where leaders who were low in, I don't know if you even knew what this was. It was, they said N power. So that's need for power. So it's within the motivational, personality literature. So the sort of motivational, wing of personality, researchers. So like that, what motivates people becomes, sort of defining aspects of their personality. So it's a wing of the personality literature. So, Fodor and Smith, I think it's, they did not find a significant effect for group cohesiveness. And I think, That's the one where they found that leaders that were low in power motivation were the most effective in avoiding groupthink and coming to and still coming to a unanimous or semi-unanimous decision. So yeah, what we think of as being a leader is this, you know, like I agree with you, is this sort of domineering, you know, very charismatic kind of person. But, you know, maybe it's the, you know, it's the lower power leaders. And I think this is one reason why the, I think many are coming around to this idea that, that women are stronger leaders. Women do tend to be lower in power motivation and higher in sort of, in a relationship motivation. So, you know, they, it's not that they have no power motivation or that they're dominated by, you know, the social, connection, but that there's more of a balance there.
And of course we're talking generally, right? You know, there are men who are perfectly low and women who are very high. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of, yeah, we never ever in psychology, of course, we never talk about, in we really don't talk about individuals much at all. We
went, right,
you know,
right,
we're
right.
talking in statistical averages and
I
such.
Just wanted to get that caveat out of the way in case somebody jumped on it.
Yes. So in talk, you know, we were going to talk about like, how does this fit in with social media? And again, I just kind of want to go back to my conversation with my student because I asked her about this and, you know, I said, you know, how do you feel about the fact that, that, you know, that in this article, they really are sort of saying, oh, well, there's no, they keep finding very, what do I want to say? Like, minimal support for groupthink in experimental research. And again, it's because I'm in psychology, you know, we see sort of, you know, experimental studies as sort of the gold standard and that kind of thing. And much of this research on groupthink is retrospective, right? Analyzing, you know, transcripts of decisions or, you know, especially in, that's what, one of the reasons why government is so fruitful for this research, because they do keep such copious notes, right, of everything that happened. And so, you know, as researchers can go back through and pore over the notes. And you know, we were talking about this, and just the issue is it has such high face validity, right? It's so, it's just essentially, it feels so true that it's not, it's like not really convincing that they keep finding just a little bit of support in the experimental literature. They can't rule it out, but they also don't find anything really robust. So I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Okay. So the question I wanted to ask was, you know, if we're going to go with a coherence or a compliance model, we're talking about introducing social pressures, for example, alienation, or the risk of alienation, people feeling that they have to adapt, they have to comply with the whims of a certain leader, even if they might disagree with them. Would it be ethical to create that kind of experiment? Is there anything we can do to create that kind of experiment that would give us the kind of supporting evidence we need?
So again, when you had emailed me that question or a version of that question, it immediately made me think of something called the minimal group paradigm. And 50 plus years of research has supported this idea that we are so enamored with forming groups and wanting to feel connected that we'll just sort of glom on to any old description of a group. And so the original research, which I'm assuming is, it's T-A-J-F-E-L. We can link to an article, but Tajfel, I'm not sure. I apologize if someone is listening with that last name. Who originally did it with artwork. And so they, you know, they showed people some artwork and they just rated, you know, how much they liked it. And without ever introducing them to anyone else, they just said, oh, you're the kind of person who likes this kind of art. So I don't know, you know, it's like abstract or something. And, you know, you're going to interact with some people who like this other kind of art. but they don't actually necessarily have to meet. By very definition, the minimal group paradigm has to be essentially built on nothing. It's arbitrary, and it has no real basis in truth or reality. It's completely arbitrary. A more common way of doing it would be to show people, like jelly beans in a jar or a whole bunch of dots on a screen, and ask them to guess how many there are. And then they just say, oh, you tend to be an overestimator or an underestimator. And you're going to talk with people who are in the opposite, or interact with people in the opposite group. And then one of the most common things to do then is to have them play a pretend game. And in this game, you might just sort of win. You might emerge as the winner, and that's, you know, reinforcing enough. Or sometimes researchers actually have like a little pool of money, and participants might leave with, you know, a few dollars, leave the experiment with a few dollars if they sort of win the game. So one of the things that the researchers pretty consistently find is, let's say there's, there's $20 or 20 points, whether it's points or dollars, to sort of distribute. So you could do 10 and 10, okay? So 10 to your in-group, 10 to the out-group. That's 20 total. Or you could do, so they give them different options in how to do the money. Or you could do 11, right, and 9, okay? You could do 12 and 8, that kind of thing. So here's one of the things that they find. That what people would rather do, they would rather give themselves 11 and the outsiders 9 than give themselves 12. Give themselves 12 and the others 11. So even though they would come out ahead by doing 12, so it's actually, what is that? That's like $23 points or whatever. So they would rather give themselves fewer points if it meant the differential was larger. Okay. So if I can give them 2 fewer points, I'm willing to give up 1 point also. So this idea that you want to not only reward yourself, but sort of punish the out group, or disadvantage the out group more even than you want to advantage the in group. Does that make sense? So it's actually astonishingly easy to do this and to demonstrate the effect of this minimal group paradigm. Now, that is not necessarily then, there's no, maybe no actual leader in that situation, right? They're just demonstrating what it means to be in an in-group and how motivated maybe we are to disadvantage an out-group. But mm-hmm. I did want to talk about a study, and it's by Packer, and this was pretty ingenious. So this was at Ohio State University, and I think there were under 100 participants. 70 or 80. And what they asked was how much these college students identified with their college. So things like, you know, so I really love being a student here at Ohio State. I really root for the team, and, you know, just sort of, strongly identified or weakly identified. So they use strongly identified as more than one standard deviation, higher, and weakly one standard deviation lower. And so they asked them those questions about how weakly or strongly identified they were with their university. And then they asked them about concerns on, you know, their concerns for the campus. And they mostly sort of centered around, too much, you know, we'll just use this example, because this was one of the examples that stands out to me, was binge drinking on campus. So that was one of the concerns. Okay. So they asked students, this is one of the concerns you listed, you know, on your list of concerns as a college student. How concerned are you about that? Okay. So they rated weak or strong identification with college, and then weak mm-hmm. or strongly concerned, say in my example of with binge drinking. And then they put people in a group, a small group. And what they found was very interesting and very relevant to social media. Okay. And I'm actually going to read my notes here, so I want to get this right. So strongly identified members, so people who were strongly identified with their university, Ohio State University, were more willing to express their strongly held opinions, okay, even if the group was unconcerned about it. If they believed that it was a collectively harmful event for the college. Okay. So if they strongly believed that binge drinking was harmful to the university that they were strongly attached to, it did not matter that the other members were coalescing towards, you know, not doing anything about binge drinking. Okay. So I'm strongly attached to Ohio State University, and I strongly believe that this is jeopardizing Ohio State University. Therefore, I am willing to put myself out in a group and say something that's not, you know, with the group. Okay. So those were people who were willing to say something against the group. Okay. But here's the thing. Identified people who weren't concerned privately about binge drinking. So they were very identified with Ohio State University, but not really too concerned. They didn't think binge drinking was that big of a problem. If they went into a group that did think binge drinking was a problem, then they went with the group. They became part of, they were not willing to express an opinion that was counter. So they didn't have an opinion, a strong opinion going in, but they were very attached to their university. And so if other people said, oh no, this matters a lot to the university, then they went along with the group. People who were not strongly identified, so they were weakly identified with their university, they just essentially displayed groupthink from the beginning. So the authors, they describe it, the spiral of silence predicted by groupthink. So there were two conditions in which groupthink appeared. One was weakly identified participants, okay, people who weren't that engaged or who did not feel that connected with the university. And the second was a group that strongly identified with the university but did not have a strong opinion going into the group. So I think that I see that very connected with sort of, you know, cancellation or, you know, other kinds of internet kinds of groupthink, because I think that many of these people are in a group that they do not feel strongly connected with. Right. And so they're not good, even if they have an opinion that's counter, you know, they're in lots of groups. Right. And it's just, this is an arbitrary group, maybe like a, you know, a minimal group paradigm kind of situation. Right. Mm-hmm. And they're not feeling strongly connected to the group. And so the minimal group paradigm predicts that you're more willing to disadvantage out groups. Right. That's the main thing. You're not so much about advantaging the in-group, but you are more interested in disadvantaging the out-group. And groupthink predicts that these people who are not that connected to the group will say nothing when the group, you know, engages in, you know, starts to make decisions in a particular direction, right? And even those who do feel quite an affinity with the group, if they don't have a strong opinion or don't feel comfortable sharing that, you know, like don't feel comfortable, maybe they've been told that their opinion isn't relevant, maybe because they're not part of a minority group or whatever, so they can't speak. Maybe they feel that they can't speak, or they've been told that they can't speak their opinion because it's not relevant. Then, you know, they also engage in the spiral of silence. So we have two things, you know, really sort of encouraging groupthink, and there's only one that would be, you know, potentially, you know, in a force, you know, for the other direction of possibly encouraging people to express a different opinion, where they are strongly connected to the group, and they have a strong opinion before they enter the group. I mean, I just, you know, there can't be as much of that as there are of the other two.
No, and the article we were looking at says that, you know, while there may be these groups in which people can express themselves, they're kind of quite few and far between as well. So that's another thing to think about. So I think the evidence seems to be fairly robust. What are your feelings?
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, it does have a lot of face validity, and there is while it's very difficult to create. I mean, I think you're absolutely right to create a groupthink situation in a lab that would be simultaneously believable and ethical. You know, is nearly impossible. We have to sort of build the, you know, sort of grab from other, you know, evidence in order to demonstrate. I don't think there's a lot suggesting that it doesn't exist. I think there's, you know, there might not [S2] Right. [S1] Be terribly robust evidence that it does exist, but they do keep finding it. And so, you know, it's maybe not as strong as we'd like, maybe not experimental, but it keeps popping up, and you know, we have a long history of those sort of the slow trickle, a long history of that.
Right. It's a little bit like dark matter.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. You know, we know it's there. We don't know what it looks like. We've never really seen it. Can't test for it, but we can kind of imply it exists. Otherwise the universe wouldn't organize itself in the way that it does. Okay. So the next question, can we really apply it to cancellation culture? I mean, one of the problems would be that Janice initially said that it would be small mm-hmm. groups. So small, not in terms of their power. So I mean, obviously he was looking at large in terms of their power and their ability to affect change on the world, but they were all relatively small groups of people meeting together. When we're talking about cancellation being fueled by social media, we're talking of groups of hundreds, if not thousands of people, many of whom won't even know each other.
Right.
So, you know, if it's at a university and there's a group of students who are offended and they know each other, or at least they exist within the same context, same geographic physical context. When we're looking at a cancel mob going crazy on Twitter and forcing universities to issue absurd apologies, as you would know, these are people who don't know each other. There are high numbers of them. You would assume that the coherency might even be low in terms of their individual needs and interests and opinions, and yet they all converge on this one point. I mean, what are your thoughts of that? How does that alter the way that we think about groupthink? Because it's certainly, I mean, from a naive point of view, it certainly seems to be something we could describe as groupthink, but it doesn't seem to correlate closely with groupthink as it's used in psychology, or at least not cleanly.
Yeah, certainly in Janice's models, I would agree. So I had sent you a few articles, and I'm kind of going off on a little tangent here, about fear of death, okay, and how, you know, sort of, it's called terror management theory, and this idea that just even the slightest hint, reminder that, oh yeah, we're all dying, right? We're all living in the process of dying, right? So whether that means, you know, sort of like focusing on, you know, asking people like what happens to your body after you die, or simply asking people survey questions in front of a funeral home, there's lots of different ways to prime people to think about their, you know, eventual demise. Okay. So the reason I sent you a few articles, and this was a few weeks back, so you probably didn't even look at them, but there are a few articles out there about the effects of COVID and terror management theory, and what that this idea may have done to exacerbate, you know, cancellations and cancel culture, and you know, other types of online bullying. That one of the things that that thinking about your impending death might do is actually prompt you to engage in more morally motivated behaviors. So again, this is like one more thing where if we put this into the mix, right, with groupthink and with minimal group paradigm, that you put, then you add this this COVID piece where people are in, they're in their homes alone, so they're in groups that are on, you know, on their computer or on their phones or whatever, which aren't real, but they're the closest thing that they have, right? And one of the things that we're all talking about and thinking about is potentially dying. You know, what do you want to do? Well, you want, there's this maybe this desire to have your life mean something, to have done something that is morally or, you know, that has value. And there's quite a few articles out there sort of exploring this idea that that there may have been an uptick, not that it didn't already exist, but that then there was an uptick, you know, when COVID hit, you know, as people started to think about either themselves dying or people in their group dying, because it's also about you want your group to go on, right?
This is very, 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 very interesting, because there were a lot of people very reasonably who made the argument, look, okay, we are now faced with an existential threat. We are going to unite and we will realize that canceling people over the tyranny of the subjective, you know, just deciding that somebody offended me and then let's all get crazy, that the people would stop doing that. And that's really not what happened. I mean, the exact opposite happened.
Yes.
And it's worth pointing out actually as well, I'm not just talking about the critical social justice types either. Certainly they did with Black Lives Matter, where, you know, people just really got behind this whole movement unquestioningly. And then the leaders of the business or the charity, I guess, that claimed ownership of it were then able to defraud them of money. You know, that kind of thing happened. But also people on, I guess I'd say my side, people that I knew who were resisting critical social justice, we saw, and let's not name any names, but we saw a lot of them go quite crazy too. We saw a lot of them kind of jump on conspiracy theories. You know, a classic example for, you know, a lot of them, for example, are jumping on right now the idea of drag queen story hour being somehow an example of grooming kids for sexual activities. Now, and what they do is that they'll point to one case in which there is some deeply objectionable human being behaving in a deplorable manner. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I've seen the examples. I take the point. But then it doesn't follow from that point that they're all doing that, right? And from what I can see, the vast majority of examples of drag queen story hour is like a pantomime dame. You know, do you have pantomimes in America? Like,
no.
He's over here. And it's okay. It's like an English thing, right? It's a kid's show, generally happens at Christmas. And there tend to be like old fashioned stories, maybe an adaptation of Charles Dickens or something like that. And there are certain characters that always make a reappearance, and one of them is a pantomime dame, which is a bloke dressed as a woman talking a bit like this. And whenever I see drag queen story hour, that's what I see most of the time. It doesn't strike me as in any way sexually subversive, again, with the caveat that I know that there are some nefarious characters there. But generally, right. that's not what's happening. And yet what happened with certainly some of the anti-woke people who, you know, who I don't believe would have acted like that before, suddenly when COVID came in, there was this drive towards purity. And they started really doing their best to denounce people in a way that they were kind of standing up against the kind of people who were doing that before themselves. So they kind of were becoming what they hated mm-hmm. in a way. So I can definitely see that this kind of terror management leading to moralizing. Is there anything on purity there?
Yes. Because
purity would be something I've anecdotally
noticed. Yeah, so we'll have to do a deep dive on that literature. But one of the things to circle back to groupthink, one of the connections, and I can't speak to whether it's addressed in those articles, but it certainly then would create that sense of urgency that Janice was saying was typical of a groupthink, right?
Right.
This like, well, if I'm going to die, I got to do this now. Right? Like, oh, I've been working on this slowly, or I'm, you know, I'm anti-woke, or I'm, you know, whatever it is that I am, right? And I got to get to be more of it quickly, because there may not be time for me. I'm very knowledgeable in this theory, in this idea, you know, area or whatever, and I need to make my impact now. So I think that, you know, that sense of urgency might maybe coupled with the sort of moral purity kind of the, you know, belief might, and, you know, and certainly that's within this model too, right? That the sort of believing that you have the moral high ground is part of the groupthink, sort of ingredients also, right? And so when you get, and so, you know, I would think that some of the people that, you know, who will remain nameless in this discussion, certainly, most certainly probably had, you know, a little cadre of people around them, right, who were, you know, supporting them and saying, yes, you know, we should go this direction. And then once they get there, there's, a ready-made group also, probably.
Yeah, and it's also worth pointing out that some people within the anti-woke movement were purged as well. You know, one of whom we know quite well. For me personally, I remember there's a funny story. I was in a bar in Tokyo just after when things had eased up and we could go out again. And I don't know if I told you this. I met some guy and he was talking about critical race theory and, you know, critical race theory being really kind of politicized at that point. But actually, like, critical race theory is quite a broad movement and the authors don't all agree with each other, right? It's not like uniform. It's not like a monolith. And this guy was raging against intersectionality, which is one of the manifestations of critical race theory. And he got onto Kimberly Crenshaw and clearly didn't know what he was talking about. And he was raging against Crenshaw saying this and that and this. And he started saying things that she didn't say. And I made the point to him. And I was like, okay, look, you kind of got that wrong. You might be critical of mapping the margins in Crenshaw, and that's fine. I would be too. But she raises some interesting points here and here. And he got really angry and ended up trying to punch me. And then started calling me woke. And, you know, I'm not a fan of intersectionality by any stretch of the imagination. I've just read it and I can recognize that there are some legitimate concerns. But yeah, I mean, I very, very much witnessed it, not just with the, you know, what we would call the woke people, the critical social justice people, but also with the people who we would previously have identified as being on our side. I'm not sure if we would anymore. I mean, I think some of them have gone completely. Some of them seem to have fallen victim to groupthink.
Right.
And
right.
they, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know that we can come down on whether groupthink is, you know, I mean, I think that both of our gut reactions and probably most people that we would talk to would say, oh yes, groupthink is a thing in social media. And maybe the theory is going to have to be expanded or revised. The other name for it is sort of group mind, right? And I definitely, you know, see that aspect of it, that, you know, people sort of becoming, you know, sort of group-minded, you know, like becoming, you know, sort of, I have this picture in one of my, lectures, and it's a little, you know, comic strip. And it's a whole bunch of people, you know, like a crowd of people walking, and there's one brain, over all of them. Mm-hmm. So all of their heads are, you know, sort of subsumed by this one brain. And that's sort of what I think sometimes about, you know, a social media group, right? That's just like the one big brain.
So here's like an interesting point, I think. Very much like in psychology, again, you're the expert, but our strengths are the same thing as our weaknesses, mm-hmm. right? Like heuristics, being able to make quick snap decisions about things, that's beneficial more than disadvantageous, but it can be profoundly disadvantageous, right? Kahneman, thinking fast and thinking slow. That's the kind of point that he makes in that book. So groupthink, as we've looked at it, as it's been identified, so Janice very much uses it to look at public policy fiascos. Throughout this podcast, we've focused on them. Then we've talked about how it seems to apply quite well, albeit with some caveats, it needs updating to social media and to cancel culture. Is it always a bad thing?
Right.
You know, if it's a feature that's seemingly so ubiquitous, I think we could probably start to make the case that it's probably positive more than it's negative. Very arguably, the whole function of language would be towards some kind of group mind, right? So that we can get together, designate tasks, the division of labor, building buildings, hunting, farming, gathering, all those kinds of activities all require language, the function of which is to bridge one brain into a semi-coherent entity. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. And I mean, you know, we always try to talk about this, right? Mm-hmm. There is no sort of, you know, human behavior that we can say is all bad or all good, right? And and that includes some things that we don't like very much, like shame, for example, when we talked about that in the previous right. podcast, you know, that there are advantages, you know, to, you know, cultural advantages, there are personal advantages, you know, there's a social communication function to shame. And I think that you know, absolutely is true of groupthink. It does get a bad rap, you know, in this article, and I think by the original, you know, Janice. But I think you're right. We can certainly imagine sometimes when, you know, again, if you go back to that sort of satisficing model, that and like your example of heuristics, that, you know, sometimes, you know, this might actually turn out to have been the better process, because maybe the naysayers would have actually, you know, taken us on the wrong path. Now, whether that's a function of groupthink being a good thing, or whether that's simply that in sort of these historical examples, they chose sort of, you know, poor outcomes, you know, to study. I mean, have they studied good outcomes to find out whether there was groupthink? I don't see that right. they have, right? At the same time, you also know that a bad process can sometimes end up producing a good result, right? So, I think that's a void in the literature that someone should address, right? They should look at some really good outcomes and the processes of those and find out whether there was, you know, elements of groupthink.
If we look at agreeableness as a trait, there is such a thing as too much and too little, right?
Yes. Now, I would kind of push back against putting everything on a bipolar scale. Mm-hmm. So I think that we are all agreeable and not agreeable. So I would say there's two different scales. So like we can be And I think it's, you know, it would be situational also, but sort of like introversion and extroversion, like we are all extroverted to some extent, and we are all introverted to some extent. And I see those as different. So although we kind of think of them as bipolar, I would actually say that they're separate. So there's agreeable, and then they're sort of like, you know, disagreeable, for lack of a better word, right? So yes, I would say that certainly too much agreeableness, you know, here's the thing. It predicts happy marriages, for example, you know, so like agreeable people tend to be more, you know, in longer lasting relationships, and they tend to have, you know, slightly lower risk of heart disease and that kind of stuff. Cause they're, you know, they're not, maybe not as, anxious about, you know, things not going their way or whatever. But I also think, like I said, that people can be agreeable in situationally, right? They can be agreeable in a marriage, but maybe not as agreeable in, you know, a work situation or something. So, but yeah, certainly we would expect people to be more agreeable, you know, to go more towards groupthink. I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, so this is bipolar as well. So we talked about when we were talking to Spencer in the last podcast we did, when he was saying patriotism. Certainly, if we look at Nazi Germany, we can see that's, or a better example would be Mussolini's fascism. That's certainly too patriotic, right? It's obvious that it's too patriotic. But then he was saying that, you know, you can have no sense of belonging at all to a country, and that would be a deficiency. So he was saying that we should be a little bit patriotic in sense that, you know, we have some sense of belonging. So he would point that in the middle of the scale. And this may be an oversimplification, but in terms of groupthink, when we're looking at any given group, I would posit that having no groupthink would mean that the group falls apart, perhaps.
Right. Or never makes a decision.
Yeah. Or never makes a decision. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And we've been in, I've been in groups like that where these meetings just take ages and ages, and you're just bored out of your juries, maybe as well, right? And you're absolutely bored out of your mind, and maybe people have got decent points on either side, but you just shut up, right?
Right.
So we've all felt that. So maybe it's a case that certainly we can see Janice has identified. I think we've begun to identify in terms of cancel culture and social media that, okay, you know, we need to revise the concept a bit, but it does seem to work quite well in describing why people are being cancelled unfairly. But also that, you know, there could be too little. And so groupthink should be seen on a scale where there is a healthy equilibrium, a healthy point in the middle. And that might actually vary according to the context. So we would want quite a lot of disagreement, for example, in a government policy institute, because these decisions need to take time. They need to be thought through and debated. But if it's a sports team where, you know, you're going to get on the field in 10 minutes time, probably, you know, we'd want quite a lot of groupthink for that context.
Yeah,
I think that's a more nuanced understanding of it, that certainly it can go too far. And that's a problem, and we should identify it. But it's not that necessarily groupthink is inherently pathological, and perhaps more often than not, it's adaptive, and that's the reason why it exists.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree, and I think even you know, even in large groups, you know, I think that while we would hope that there would be, you know, space for disagreement and that kind of thing, you know, at some point, you know, do you want to have large groups of people like at each other all the time over every little thing? You know, probably not. So it would probably be better to say, like, that, you know, part of the group thing would be like, we're just not going to go there, right? That's not what this group is about. And so we're not going to bother to disagree about those things, because that's not, you know, we're a knitting group. I think actually there was a cancellation, you know, within a knitting group.
Oh, no.
Yes, there was. Yes. And it was horrible, but you know, like if we're a knitting group, let's converge on some things and not really, go beyond that. So yes, there was.
Certainly. I had a friend of mine, come up to me, and she's in a, Facebook group called something, I can't remember, but it's something like the Sisterhood of Reading. And it's all about, it's a women's group for reading. Fine, you know, but yeah. Apparently some people in there saying this is not inclusive towards trans people, and can we, you know, stop using gendered pronouns with each other and stuff. It's like, really.
Yeah. So dissent is good, but maybe not. Do we have to interject dissent for the purposes of interjecting dissent when it's not, this isn't war policy, you know, public policy, right? This isn't Egypt, and Israel.
It's a knitting group.
So we don't necessarily need to interject alternative opinions into every group process. I think you're right.
Okay, good. And I think that's probably quite a good place to end it on. So I think we've come to this conclusion that groupthink needs revision. But it certainly does seem to apply to the problems that we have with social media and cancellation culture today quite well. There does seem to be kind of quite a lot of evidence, although it doesn't directly tie in. It seems to fit quite well. It's hard to test. But like dark matter, you know, it does seem to be out there. It does seem to explain lots of social phenomena. And finally, that while it does produce negative consequences, it is born of something that is, we've probably adapted evolutionary, that can deliver positive outcomes as well, and probably delivers more positive outcomes than negative ones, dependent upon the context. Good.
Okay. It was good to see you.
It's good to see you too.